Okay. I want to first thank the organizers for inviting me, but also putting this talk in just about the perfect spot. You'll see why soon. So I want to start with the following question. Why don't we have a large-scale quantum computer? And the simple answer is noise. If you look at the classical computers, I did some digging, and apparently in the 1990s, already you had a noise rate of around the order of 10 to the minus 15. And back then, the primary source of errors were neutrons that are coming from the cosmic rays. Now, I don't know exactly what the primary source of errors are in quantum computing, but I'm pretty sure that the cosmic neutrons are not their primary concern at the moment. Because if you look at the error rate, at best, they're around the order of, let's say, 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3 at the moment. To combat this problem, we have this nice theory, the so-called theory of fault tolerance. And it says that if you have a set of gates and preparations and measurements that you can implement with an error rate below a certain threshold, then up to a Pauli logarithmic overhead, you can simulate arbitrary quantum computation with a noisy quantum device. Now, that's all great, but if you over the past few years, I've learned that there are a lot of things that in the theory land is not really a problem, but in actuality, this could be a problem. I'm not saying that these are the problems that is impossible to solve, but it's not something that will be solved, like, let's say, tomorrow. Like, one of those questions is, like, say, can you fit millions of qubits in a single fridge? Well, maybe. I mean, it's probably possible, but nobody has done that so far. And also, let's say you have a quantum computer which is completely error-free, but its clock speed is like 1 hertz. So there's no error, but you can implement one gate per second. Probably there will be some limitation on its practical usefulness if the quantum computer is too slow. Then you may think, oh, if the physical gate that you implement is fast, then you won't have this problem. And actually, this is not true either, because if your gate is too fast, in order to make sure that the errors do not accumulate, you have to decode fast enough. And if your classical hardware can't keep up with that calculation, then then you won't be able to do that. And there will be all kinds of problems that are yet to be discovered. And I don't want to say it in a negative way, but I'm just saying that we're not going to have a large-scale quantum computer tomorrow. But it is very likely that we will have a noisy quantum computer with a noise rate of, say, 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3, something around that line, consisting of, let's say, 50 to 100 qubits. And the question that I would like to ask is, what should we do with these devices? In this direction of research, there are some line of reasoning that we should not think about large-depth quantum circuits, and therefore we should focus on short-depth quantum circuits. And I would like to criticize on this so-called logic. It usually goes along the following way. It's not like written in any papers or anything like that, but usually when I talk to people, this is the usual conversation that occurs. It starts with the following sentence. Without error correction, error keeps accumulating, and therefore in the long run, the effect of error cannot be bounded, and therefore such circuits will be completely useless without error correction. I don't have any problem with this logic itself, but I do have a problem with the first statement, which is that without error correction, error keeps accumulating, and because this is actually simply not true. And the main topic of this talk is to explain why certain circuits, despite having a large depth, do not accumulate error as much as you think they do. So this is the obligatory definition for quantum information slides. It's the only definition slide, so don't worry too much. I'll have some pictures soon. Basically, what I mean by noise-resilient circuits is the following. I'm considering a family of circuits with hopefully increasing qubit numbers, and I call it as a k-noise-resilient if for every bounded operator, which are k-local, meaning that you're trying to measure k-point correlation functions. And what it's saying is that if you compare a state that is prepared by a noiseless circuit, and compare that to the expectation value of a noisy circuit, where every gate preparation and measurement becomes noisy with, let's say, noise rate epsilon. Of course, assuming that you have a simple initial state, let's say a product state, then their expectation value differs from each other by an order epsilon. The important point is that this constant C is independent of N, so even if you have a large enough circuit, this thing does not blow up. And if you think about it, a trivial example of noise-resilient circuit is a finite disk quantum circuit. The reason is very simple. If you look at any like K-point observable, the number of circuit elements that can potentially influence that observable is, let's say, order one. Therefore, these circuits are noise resilient. And the whole point is that they're actually noise resilient circuits that are not short depths. So just to get an intuition on what's going on, physically what I'm thinking is that you have some qubits on a grid or like one-dimensional line like this. And by saying that I'm going to study noise resilient circuits, I'm saying that I want to care about observables that are, let's say, on these two red dots or these two red dots, or those two, but I will simply do not care about observables which are highly non-local, such as these ones. That's what I'm trying to do. So here are the four agendas that I want to discuss in this talk. I want to first discuss, I want to argue why noise resilience is actually important and why it has some meaning and why it can be useful. And then I want to discuss a very general intuition behind how noise resilience works. And then I want to point out there are actually circuits that we know which are noise resilient. It's just that people didn't think of it that way. And lastly, if I have enough time, I want to discuss how we can use this to do something practical. So I want to make a comment. I want to make a comment on a different notions of errors. So in quantum computing, you often hear this 1 over poly n precision. So you do some computation in polynomial time, and then you get certain number that you want up to 1 over poly n precision. That's great. I don't have anything against that. But the point that I want to make is that not every bit of useful information requires such a precision. Some very coarse observables, let's say average observables, such as the energy per site, for instance, is the figure of merit for comparing different numerical methods in the studies of quantum many-body physics. For example, let's say you have a numerical method A, call it a DMRG, and you have a numerical method B, let's say, I don't know, call it this DMRG prime, and let's say they computed some ground state energy of the same model, and if the method A gives you the lower energy than method B, then the game is that method A wins, okay? This is a game that people have been playing for years. And also, for macroscopic observables, such as, let's say, magnetization per site, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that it's a poly n's digit doesn't really provide particularly useful information for a physicist.
You mean the log n's digit?
If you mean one of the okay, so log n's digit, too. Yeah, yeah, anything that scales with n. So in the context of this quantum many-body physics and numerical methods, the name of the game is really that the lower the energy per site you have a better method. And the important thing to remember is that the differences of energy per site between different methods is really order one, not order one over poly n. The question that I want to ask is, can a near-term quantum device participate in this game and report an energy per site that is smaller than any of the existing classical methods? This is the problem that I want to pose. So obviously, in case it wasn't obvious, I want to show, in a way, by doing this sort of experiment, that quantum computers can do something that the existing classical computers can't do. But if you look at the slides, I'm not really using the word supremacy. I'm trying to be much more modest here. I'm just trying to look at a particular task that people care about, such as determining the ground state phase diagram of some controversial model, such as anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg model on Kalkofen lattice. This is a kind of model that people seem to switch their mind every 2 years on what exactly the phase diagram is. And also there's this famous Fermi-Hubbert model on square lattice. And the simple fact of the matter is, physicists have worked really hard on beating each other's energy for decades. So I would say if we beat them in this game, then that's a pretty convincing argument that the quantum computer is doing something that we can't do yet. moreover, it will actually be useful. Like, if this thing succeeds, then you will be able to measure things like energy per site, magnetization per site, which is something that you can observe macroscopically, and also understand how your behavior changes under an infinitesimal change in the underlying parameter. And so that you can calculate things like magnetic susceptibility or bulk modulus. These are practical, these are numbers that are of practical interest that material scientists care about, or so I was told. So I want to talk about the intuition behind noise resilience. It turns out that the intuition is quite general, and because of that, instead of attacking each of these examples individually, I want to have one guiding example, which is not terribly useful, but it'll we'll be able to learn some lessons from it. So, and that example is based on the so-called matrix product state. So what I'm basically going to show is that generically, a unitary circuit that prepares a matrix product state is a large steps, yet a noise resilient circuit. So the reason why this works is the following. So it turns out that if you have a matrix product state, generically speaking, you can write down a unitary circuit that prepares that particular matrix product state. And this is a particularly simple version of that. So the way it works is that you begin with some initial state, let's say all zero state, and then you prepare, then you apply a sequence of unitaries in this particular order. So if you want to measure an expectation value of some local observable, say, supported on these first two sites, which is represented by the black box, you basically contract a tensor network. So we say that these black boxes, this black box and the blue boxes, once contracting the first qubit, becomes this new black box, and these three becomes a new black box. So you can just keep doing it all the way to the end. And if you think about it, in the previous slides, at every time step, you have basically only touched two qubits at most. So what's really going on, a different way to interpret the circuit diagram is that at each time, a fresh ancilla is introduced, and it interacts with the system, and then the system is discarded, and the ancilla becomes the new system. So let's see how that works. So in these new diagrams, I'm basically ignoring the circuits that has not been enacted so far. So this is the first circuit, and that's the second one, and that's the third one. And the pattern keeps repeating. So the way you should think about these things is that is the following diagram. So imagine you have your physical qubits that are arranged on a line. And imagine you have this virtual qubit. This is the so-called virtual space in the tensor network language. And what you're basically doing is that you initialize your physical qubits in some product state, and also you initialize your virtual qubit in some state. And then at each time step I, you apply some unitary operation on the composite between V and I. So you do that on the first qubit and move on to the second one. And again, the pattern keeps repeating. So if you do once you do the math, what you realize is that the expectation value of a let's say some local observable can be written down in the following form. So these individual operators, these are what's called as the transfer operators in the matrix product state language, and they have some nice properties such as the fact that it's norm non-increasing, and in case you notice things, it's also a unital channel. And that means that it has eigenoperators with eigenvalues lambda, which is smaller or equal to 1. And so I want to make a distinction between the eigenoperators with eigenvalues equal to, whose modulus is equal to 1, and the ones whose modulus is strictly smaller than 1. I want to call the first one as the oscillating mode, and the second one as the decaying mode. It's worth noting that, generically speaking, the identity operator is the only eigenoperator with lambda equals to 1. So in most cases, except for the identity operator, most of the modes will be decaying. So imagine you have that matrix product state, that circuit that I showed you a couple of slides ago, and imagine you replace every circuit element with a noisy version. So you replace zero state with some mixed state, which is close to the zero state, and you replace the unitary operator with some noisy channel, which is close to that unitary operator. And in case, and if you look at how the expectation value changes, this is simple numerics that you can do. It turns out that for the oscillating modes, as you expected, the total amount of error increases in time, and it blows up at an order which is around the order of 1 over epsilon. This is completely expected, nothing unusual. But if you do the same thing for the decaying modes, what you realize is that the errors initially increase, but at some point, it just stops increasing and saturate. At short times, the reason why you have low level of errors is pretty obvious. It's because you didn't have enough fault locations, so there was very little ways in which the noise could accumulate. But the non-trivial part comes from the long time dynamics, and I want to discuss the intuition behind this. So in the long time case, what's roughly going on is the following. So if you look at the total amount of perturbation that can happen at, say, time large t, then that can be upper bounded by the sum of the effect that has occurred before that time. But the thing is, that effect decays exponentially in t minus t, and this is just a property, this is based on the fact that these modes are decaying. And in particular, if you sum all of these things together, the total amount of error is, like, it turns out to be order epsilon, which is independent of large t. So there are a couple of comments that I want to make. The first is that MPS is actually something that's useful. It can describe gapped 1D systems efficiently. And I've argued that the contraction of matrix product state is actually noise resilient, even though the circuit depth scales with the system size. So it gives you a non-trivial example of noise resilient circuit. But this is not terribly useful because we can already, yes?
So it's not completely fair to say on the circuit scales, maybe it's a circuit size, because there's another circuit that prepared the same MPS before anything else.
That's true, yeah, okay, that's fair. But we'll see, yeah, this is just for intuition's sake, and I just want to extend this argument to, I want to, if you do that in logarithmic this, the argument that I want to make doesn't quite work in the direction that I want to talk about. So, yeah, bear with me. Okay, so I want to discuss tell you that there are actually noise resilient circuits that we've known for a while, but we just didn't think about them in that way. And there's a general design principle that I want to propose. The first is that the circuit must be non-trivial, by which I mean the noiseless circuit. If you don't have noise, if you apply to some simple to prepare state, say some product state, it should output a key point correlation function of states that are of interest to, let's say, physicists. And it has to have some sort of advantage, which is that, namely, there must be an advantage in running the circuit over simulating it on a classical computer. And thirdly, I want this circuit to be noise resilient. So one example of that is a certain subclass of PEPs. So remember, in the matrix product state, the picture was that you have this physical qubit and virtual qubit, and the virtual qubit is kind of flying along a single line and sequentially interacting with each of the physical qubits. Now imagine you generalize that to a rows of qubits. So now you have each of the physical qubit is replaced by a row of physical qubits, and each of the virtual qubits is replaced by a rows of virtual qubits. And instead of trying to apply arbitrary unitary operation, you apply a finite depth unitary operation per time. So even though it's finite depth unitary per time, the total depth of the circuit scales in this picture linear with LX. So it turns out that this onsets, even though it's a special subclass of PEPs, can describe any Levin wind model or a quantum double model. And it has an advantage over the classical methods, because if you simply try to do arbitrary dynamics over a 1D system, presumably it'll take a time that scales exponentially with Ly. But in this case, you can just run the circuit, and the total amount of time that it takes is linearly with Lx. And I don't have too much time to discuss the criterion under which this becomes noise resilience, but if you have questions about this, please ask me later. And the second example that I want to discuss is is the so-called mirror-like circuits. So yesterday, people talked about all kinds of tensor networks, so I don't have to explain to you what these things are. So the idea itself is very simple. So in MIRA, you have a set of quantum circuits consisting of order log n layers, and each layer consists of, let's say, depths to locality preserving quantum circuits. And the one layer is called as an isometry, and the other layer is called as the disentangler. What we're simply proposing is that to decompose the chi-dimensional Hilbert space into order log chi number of qubits, and to be experimentally friendly, decompose all the circuits into the two qubit gates. And each layer consists of depths d locality preserving quantum circuits, as opposed to depths two locality preserving quantum circuits. And our motivation for doing this is on one side, it's obviously experiment, but on the other side, as Michael told us yesterday, for certain class of models, one can show that the ground state correlation function can be described with d is with order d that scales roughly like log 1 over delta, if you want a precision of delta. So these are some of the examples. So each of these boxes represents a quantum circuit, and down here you have 512 qubits. And this is a depth d equals 2 mirror. And what the red boxes are representing are the circuits that can influence the observer that is located down here. So depth 3, 4, 5, and it keeps on going. And if you write down, again, the expectation value of local observable, what you realize is that just like the case of the matrix product state, it can be represented as a sequence of as a state that is evolving under some dissipative dynamics. And the thing is, you can efficiently calculate these things on a classical computer, by which I mean it can be computed in time 2 to the c d times log n. So the dependence on n is order log n, so that's great. But the problem is this constant prefactor is, in practice, a problem. Especially if you go to higher dimensions, let's say in two dimensions, this thing scales exponentially with large d to the small d, which I was told that this is why, even though MIRA is efficient, if you just look at the scaling of the n, this is why in practice there are some difficulties in implementing with the existing classical hardware. The thing is, if you do the same thing on a quantum computer, you can basically do this job in order d log n. So it's really a constant prefactor. So you might think it's not really a big deal, but I just want to emphasize that we're trying to do something that we can't do currently, and it's this constant prefactor that is preventing us from using a mirror in higher dimensions. Yes?
So on a quantum computer, you're trading time for space, I think, and you could do the same in a classical computer.
Well, it's really the memory size in the MIRA case, right? I mean, it's like let's say you have a so last time I checked, the total amount of memory that you need for MIRA calculation scales like chi to the n, where n is a high power, and it's simply not easy to store that on a classical computer. Like if you want chi to be around the order of like say 10 when you go to two dimensions. And here you need order like log chi qubits. So it's really the memory.
Yeah? Want to make some implicit assumption that this isometry in the mirror can be efficient.
So we're considering a variant of MIRA in which we are replacing these chi to the n dimensional isometries and unitaries into two qubit gates.
But that's not
So it could be. It could be, but based on this, so I mean we're doing some extrapolation here, right? I mean we have this so according to Michael's result, there is a class of models for which you can do this for which you can decompose these chi-dimensional tensors into two cubic gates without compromising too much of the depth, and we are hoping, well. At the end of the day, you're going to have to run this thing and see if it works or not. It's just a proposal. But if, let's be an optimist for a while and just consider the best case scenario and what could potentially happen. So it turns out that if you do the error analysis for a deep mirror in a deep spatial dimensions, there are two primary sources of errors. One is the approximation error, that coming from the fact that you're using a finite bond to finite depths. And the second is coming from the fact that you have this gate measurement preparation error, which scales roughly like this. So if the approximation error indeed scales exponentially small with D, then this would require order log 1 over epsilon to the D qubits, which is a modest number. So I would say this is something that is worthwhile trying with the near-term quantum computer. And those are just error bounds, which doesn't really tell you the actual error that you would get in practice. So we did some numerical experiment. So this is what we did. So we placed a random SU4 on each circuit locations and compute the nearest neighbor reduced density matrix brute force with and without noise. And the noise model is simple. It's applying the polarizing noise with error rate of 10 to the minus 3 after you apply this SU4. And then you compute the trace distance. So in this table, D is the D that I told you in the previous slides. And the errors are a number of error spots that can where the depolarizing noise occurred. And as you can see, the like if you employ the naive error bound, you would expect p times total number of errors to be order 1. But as you can see, it doesn't blow up so badly. Of course, for physical states, the actual bound that you get might be worse. But I think this is an encouraging result. Okay. So since I don't have enough time, I want to kind of go through this rather quickly. So like, imagine that everything works, and then how would you be able to actually use these these noise resilient circuits? There has been a work in the quantum chemistry community which basically can be summarized by the following picture. So you have a small quantum computer, and it outputs the expectation values of local observables to test the energy per site. So what you do is that you feed that data into the classical computer. And on the classical computer side, you do an optimization which, given an input of the objective function, tries to minimize that objective function. Of course, as in any variational calculations, this method can get stuck. But that has never stopped any of the variational calculations in the previous. I mean, it's not like you always have a guarantee that it'll work. And That's very rarely the case. So again, I would say that this is something that's worth trying. And because if you have decomposed everything into two qubit gates, it's basically the objective function is a quadratic form in the unitary gates. You can sort of have an idea on what can go on. And this is a typical plot when we try some very simple optimization. Again, you can ask me later if you want. So I want to end with some couple of comments and speculations. So it seems to me that quantum computer is really good at contracting tensor networks in a certain way. And the contraction of physical tensor networks seems to be resilient to noise. This is not a rigorous statement, but it's just a general observation. And the basic, I guess what I want to say the most is that tensor networks are efficient, but not all of them are practical yet. They could be, but not yet. But the thing is, we are likely to have these medium to large scale quantum computers which are noisy, and these might be just the right kind of hardware that can do the tensor network calculations, which are kind of infeasible at the moment. So I want to end with this outlook. I found this little anecdote. Apparently, we think there's this digital computer, came out of nowhere and solved every problem. But apparently, in the early 20th century, there was this analog machine, which essentially solved some differential equation. And people actually used this thing. And I hope we can use noisy quantum computers to a very specialized but useful task in the near future. Thank you.
Thanks, Isaac. And so Debbie's going to help me out with questions, and it's now open for questions. I'll start it off. I missed a bit this restriction on the PEPs that you were looking at. Can you go over that again? Sorry.
Sure.
Was it you're basically just making them quasi 1D? Is that the idea?
That's right. Yeah. This slide.
Yeah.
So the statement is that for these models, the ground state of these models, such as Levin-Wynn model or quantum double model, there exists a locality-preserving quantum circuits per each time step. So at every time step, what you do is that you apply some locality-preserving quantum circuit over this these row of qubits and the row of virtual qubits, and then you trace out certain virtual qubits, and then move those virtual qubits to the, let's say, the second row, and then repeat the same procedure. There exists a circuit such form that prepares the ground state of these models.
And is that sort of special to these models, or do you think this is a general?
The models, if the ground state is dressed by a finite depth local unitary, I expect the same conclusion to hold. And more generally, the argument is based on this entropy area law and the fact that in these models, the area law holds exactly. And from that, you can infer the existence of certain channels that prepares these ground states.
Yes, so quantum computers will probably be very good at simulating dynamics. So you've shown a few examples of where you can simulate the static properties.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, pretty clearly, if you do constant time evolution, it should be noise resilient. Can you think of other situation?
I did think about this, but all the thoughts that I had usually stopped at the speculative level. I wish I can show that under, let's say, eigenstate thermalization hypothesis holds, one might be able to derive some rigorous error bound on some dynamical quantities. But I was not able to make any progress in this direction.
So continuing on the sort of speculative level, do you have I can see how the sort of noise or errors wash out in sort of coarse graining, but one would presumably like to retain sort of genuinely quantum features that make the utility of the quantum computer good. So do you have an intuition for how the quantum features are not sensitive to the noise?
Maybe I'm too pessimistic, but I kind of feel like all these quantum like entanglement features will be washed away in these methods.
So wouldn't that make the quantumness of the computer not really any more superior to the
potentially
possible?
It's worth noting that actually we're asking a slightly different question here in the context of complexity theory, because here we care about the scaling in 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is your target error rate. And there is a classical method that can do every single one of the things that I told you here, but that scales either exponentially in 1 over epsilon or exponentially in 1 over epsilon squared, whereas here it scales let's say, or something around the order of 1 over epsilon. So it's really a, like a practical difference. Like there's no scaling in like n here, right?
Yeah, I was just wondering, so your definition of K noise resilient uses, you basically look at all the K local operators and you ask that their expected values are within epsilon. Do you think it would make sense to talk about a different measure like completely bounded norm or something? Or I guess your motive, or are you just motivated by the sort of practical notion that we only care about extracting these expected values up to some error? So
let's see. I mean, I would be surprised if you can't prove anything on, because every I'm basically manipulating channels here, right? So I would be surprised that I can prove like K noise resilience, but I can't prove like some channel version of it.
You'll probably have to pick up a square root of epsilon.
Okay. That's the problem. Yeah, that's not very desirable.
No.
Yeah. In that case, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Three conditions which were describing for you what you meant by noise resilience. I was wondering whether the traditional notions of fault tolerance fit inside those definitions, and whether, I mean, so you stated them in natural language, and the question is how far you can formalize those definitions.
For fault tolerance, I mean, it is necessary to enforce a K to scale, like scale with the system size, and also epsilon to be, let's say, 1 over poly n. But I'm not even sure if that'll be like sufficient, right? Because like usually in fault tolerance, you like bound the one norm of the output distributions between like a noisy and a noiseless case, and here like. The way in which this is formulated is that you only care about like k-point correlation functions. So the bound based on k-point correlation functions to one norm is pretty terrible as the number of qubits increases. So I'm not sure like if there's a nice way to fit this into the fault tolerance framework or like make it comparable.
But in fact, I have a similar question: whether how your resilience here compared with Daniel's more relaxed definition for fault tolerance for a small system.
This is probably even more relaxed than.
Right.
Well, I mean.
But it looks like they are in slightly orthogonal direction in relaxing the original definition, and maybe they can be composed together, or they can be used to help one another out that way, or.
I see. I have not thought about that very seriously yet. But it's, yeah, unfortunately, I don't have anything interesting to say.
So I have another question about this slide, actually, about like preparing quantum doubles. So there's two ways of doing this. You can do it really using this PEPS method, but you can also do it using somehow some RG scheme, some Mira scheme.
That's right.
So which one of the two is more error resilient?
Oh, I feel like Mira would be a better choice because you simply need less qubits. But like I actually had like hardwares in mind specifically. So like these PEPs, I would imagine these things are more suitable for superconducting qubits because, well, these superconducting qubits, you can't really do like a long-range two-qubit gates. So to do the Mira type calculation, I'm kind of assuming that you need to be able to do these long-range gates, which makes sense in the case of ion traps, but it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense in the case of superconducting qubits. So because of that reason, I think it's really the hardware that you should keep in mind. So there's probably for the superconducting qubits, this PEPS would be a better approach. I don't know, does that answer your question?
Just a clarification, I think you've explained this, but I didn't catch it. So the output of your circuit tells you like energy per site to sufficient accuracy, but I didn't catch. Are you saying if you were to then evaluate an entanglement entropy or a correlation function at large separation, it would not correctly give you that, or?
Probably it'll fail, I think, yes. I would be surprised if that works.
So in the meta-construction, it seems to me that you only need to actually follow the evolution. If your goal is to compute the reduced density metrics on a region to evaluate the energy eventually, you don't need to build a whole wave function. Mm-hmm. You just can restrict your attention to that causal cone. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't that clarify all these resources that you were discussing, or the hardware would be simplified a lot by that? You don't really need to build a whole wave function if all you are going to do is use that as a part of an optimization method.
That's true. I mean, so if I'm understanding you correctly, so like the point is that you don't need like all the, like let's say you want to do Mara calculation over like 10,000 qubits, you don't actually need 10,000 qubits. Yeah, I completely agree
you
with you.
You need log n.
You need log, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Here, Isaac. So there is a little bit of literature on upper bounds to fault tolerant threshold, right? So if there's if there's more than some amount of noise, then the circuit becomes classically simulatable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And here it seems like you have, and it turns out that these upper bounds are pretty high. Mm-hmm. But here you have a more relaxed condition, right? You don't look at the global error, you look at only local error. So it seems that under this assumption, you could probably lower that upper bound quite a bit. Is that something you've thought about? Like, you know, if the circuit becomes too noisy, then it can be simulated classically, if all you care about are k-point correlation functions. Is that something you've thought about?
No, not yet. But yeah, we should talk about that, though.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so this is kind of following up Gifre's question. I mean, in order to use a variational method, mm-hmm. Maybe you don't need to reconstruct a global wave function, but you need to know that there is a global wave function that's consistent with your local ones.
That's a very good point, yeah.
And particularly when there's errors, how do you make sure of that?
So let me first say that for the PEPS case, we don't have this problem. Essentially, the laws of quantum mechanics like tells you, like as long as you know that you're, trust your measurements up to, let's say, error epsilon. In the case of the PEPS, actually, this is easy to see. So, like, whatever you're doing here, like sliding these rows of qubits and letting them interact with each other, you're doing some physical process. So at the end of the day, the state that you get over these physical qubits, it is an actual physical state. So the only place in which this variational calculation can go wrong is lies in the measurement, in this particular case. Now, having said that, for the Mara case, I don't have that kind of guarantee yet. But I'm hoping that by arranging the qubits correctly, I can get the same kind of guarantee.
I think we're pretty much out of time, so let's thank Isaac again.